Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Budweiser Beer, the great American lager, is Belgian-owned now. After five generations in the USA, American ownership of its brewer, Anheuser-Busch, is gone abroad. From famous old skyscrapers to cutting-edge high-tech firms, American assets and companies are being snatched up by foreign owners at a record pace. The weak dollar makes them look like a bargain. But what does it mean for Americans when ownership goes overseas? This hour on Point, what it means for Americans when the U.S. is up for sale. A special welcome today to our newest listeners on KVCR in San Bernardino, California. It's great to have you. Later in this hour, we will look at those controversial market sharks, the short sellers, who have made at least $1.4 billion in July, we're told, betting against Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Look at their impact on the U.S. economy. But first, joining me from St. Louis with the latest word on Budweiser is Jeremiah Williams, business reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who's been covering the sale of Anheuser-Busch to Belgian giant InBev. Jeremiah, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Nothing more American-sounding, Jeremiah, than Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch. Listen with us for just a second to this ad, if you would. 1986, Anheuser-Busch ad opens with the image of the American Eagle.
Made in America, that means a lot to me. Oh, I believe in America and American quality.
Anheuser-Busch is the same personal commitment to quality that has kept our family beers the finest in the world for over 100 years.
Jeremiah, you know that marketing message well. I can't think of any American who wouldn't. Budweiser has been synonymous with kind of American spirit, American soul, American beer for a long time. How is St. Louis taking this news?
Well, that's absolutely right, Tom, and Budweiser's also been kind of St. Louis, or synonymous with St. Louis for a long time, too. Those radio commercials often bring up the fact, you know, Budweiser beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Sure.
And that's a big source of local pride. I mean, Anheuser-Busch ranks among the top three in terms of employment and market value and profits, revenue, and all of that. But I think their impact on the local community goes beyond the numbers. They are far and away our most iconic company. And the fact that they could be bought out so quickly after maybe a month and a half of negotiations, that kind of strikes at a bit of pride in St. Louis, and it has caused a lot of angst, a lot of frustration, probably a lot of fear as well.
We're going to look at what this may mean for St. Louis and for the beer, but why did it happen? What made Anheuser-Busch open or vulnerable, or however you want to put it, to take over by this big European brewing giant?
Well, there are a number of things, Tom. One is that the stock, Anheuser-Busch's stock, has been relatively flat over the last 5 years, and that has left them vulnerable. Another is the fall of the dollar, and since InBev does its business in euros, or keeps its books in euros, the appreciation of the euro makes them a lot stronger, makes them able to buy Anheuser-Busch. But Anheuser-Busch has to be put on the block as well for some of their business strategy, being so focused on the United States, which is admittedly a big market, very profitable market, but it's not growing fast. And they became conservative in the early part of this decade and sat out a bunch of international deals that could have kept them the number one international brewery, and they lost out on that spot a few years ago.
Now, what do you know about InBev? I see Business Week here calling them, saying they have a reputation as machete-wielding investment bankers. Whoa, watch out. What do you know about them?
Well, exactly. They were formed through the creation of the company in 2004. They're a merger of a Belgian company and a Brazilian company, and they are now the world's number two brewer. With the completion of this deal, they'll be far and away the number one. But their business model is basically a lot of acquisitions, dozens of mergers over the years through their predecessor companies, and then very massive cost cuts. They drive a lot of profits and pull those profit margins wider. But that is their business model, to have very aggressive budgeting. Every year, their managers have to demonstrate that they can keep the budget that they have the previous year. So it's a very Spartan culture focused on cost cutting. The executives sit around one big table. They fly coach. These are kind of legendary cost cuttings in the beer industry. And that's caused a lot of worry in St. Louis that, wow, what is this going to look like in the next few years as this kind of culture sweeps into St. Louis?
And very different for Anheuser-Busch, who's, longtime CEO August Busch III used to routinely make a 10-mile commute to work by helicopter, 2 free cases of beer every month for Anheuser-Busch employees. There was plenty of community support in its philanthropic budget.
Well, that's absolutely right, Tom. There is clearly some fat to trim in Anheuser-Busch's budget. Anheuser-Busch itself said that it was going to cut $1 billion over the next few years. That was as a defensive strategy to try to fend off InBev. Now they're saying they can cut $1.5 billion out of the combined companies. But you're right. The company's been very generous. They gave $10 million last year to local charities, which makes them easily the biggest contributor. They have people into the brewery tours. The tours are free, and they attract 350,000 people every year to St. Louis. They have Grant's Farm, which is an estate out in the country, kind of the historic home of the Busch family. So their impact is very big, and yes, they are very generous in the local community. It's hard to drive down the street around here and not notice that Anheuser-Busch is plastered on the buildings of our local universities and what have you, so they are everywhere out here.
Budweiser, America's first national beer brand, introduced in 1876. What about the beer itself? Is it going to change? Stella Artois, or however you say it, is InBev's big brand. Are they going to change the recipe for Bud?
No, they're saying they're not. I believe them. I think that would be a serious problem. Anytime you change a recipe for a venerable beer brand, that creates a lot of problems and also creates opportunities for your competitor to say, oh, Budweiser's changing. Clearly, Anheuser-Busch doesn't want that, and I very much doubt InBev would want that. But InBev CEO Carlos Brito says Budweiser is America in a bottle. So he's very excited about sending Budweiser to markets, international markets, where it's not really available now, and kind of playing off of that American legacy and quality and using those massive sports sponsorships that we know all about, the World Cup, the Olympics, to raise awareness and also send that beer into markets.
$52 billion for the company. What about the Busch family and other big stakeholders? We know Cindy McCain has a small stake through her distributorship in Arizona. But what about the money that major holders will take home here? Must be huge.
Well, it's going to be huge. We won't know the full details probably until the proxy statement comes out. That'll be filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. But it's pretty clear that the Busch family will have some serious earnings from this deal. But I talked to August Busch IV, the current CEO, and he said, yes, this is a very difficult decision. And clearly, I think he's torn. I think he's torn that he has a duty to shareholders to seek the best value for the company. But this is a company that wasn't really for sale. I think August Busch IV made it clear that he was not interested in selling. This is before the rumors really popped up. But he had to do what he had to do as well as the Anheuser-Busch board. But going back five generations and your name is on the company headplate, I mean, it goes beyond the money, I think, and he would acknowledge that.
Jeremiah, what about the marketing challenge here? The new InBev CEO may call it America in a bottle, but we have so many associations. After 9/11, there was the famous television ad of the Clydesdales sort of kneeling, as I recall it, in the snow with their big beer wagon toward them, toward the spot where the Twin Towers would have stood. I mean, only, it seems to me, a completely American entity could have its kind of brand representatives doing something like that. Is the Budweiser brand going to have to in some way change? Will it still have credibility as America's lager?
Well, that's a great question, Tom. And they also had a commercial in the Super Bowl 3 years ago where troops are spontaneously applauded as they're walking through the airport. You may recall that. But that kind of marketing, I think, is brilliant. And it really drew up the close relationship that Anheuser-Busch has had with America and specifically with the armed forces. But you bring up a great point that kind of credibility, some people may call that into question because Anheuser-Busch itself has criticized Miller Brewing and Coors Brewing Company for being bought out by foreign companies. And they recently pointed out that, yes, Anheuser-Busch is the only large American-owned brewer anymore. Well, that's going to change. So I don't know whether consumers will really ding them on that point. But the company company is clearly aware that that could be a problem. And August Bush said, we can work around that problem with smart marketing and good community relations. So clearly it's on the radar screen, though.
Jeremiah, very practically, for St. Louis, what's known, promised, or anticipated about employment there, headquarters, employee numbers, and all the rest with the takeover?
Well, here's what InBev is saying. They're saying St. Louis will be the North American headquarters for InBev's operations. Right now, obviously, it's the world headquarters for Anheuser-Busch. Also, they're saying that all 12 breweries would stay open, including the flagship in St. Louis. But there are serious cuts being planned in Anheuser-Busch's salaried employment, which is heavily skewed towards St. Louis. And also, InBev is talking about corporate overlap, cutting corporate overlap. So that sounds very ominous in St. Louis. One analyst told me, you know, the building will still be there on Pestalozzi Street, the headquarters building, but there would be a lot fewer people looking out of those windows. So we'll have to see what impact it will have, but clearly people are worried.
Jeremiah McWilliams with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch business reporter there. Jeremiah, thanks for all your reporting on this, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. companies, U.S. assets for sale, and going fast to foreign buyers in a time of weak dollar and strong foreign companies going global around us. What do you think about the ownership of Anheuser-Busch and Bud going overseas? Here's a Budweiser beer ad from 1976 with those strapping Clydesdale horses pulling the beer wagon.
How'd you like to ride along with the Budweiser Clydesdale? Well, here we go.
Here comes the king.
Here comes the king. Here comes the big number one.
Here comes the king.
Budweiser beer, the king is second to none.
Budweiser beer,
the king is coming.
Let's hear the call. When you say Bud, you said it all. When you say Bud, you said it all. Yeah.
Thanks for the ride, fellas.
And now maybe those Clydesdales have to swim over from Belgium. I don't know. You can join us, 800-423-8255. We want to look at the significance of growing foreign ownership of American assets in this hour. Whether it helps or hurts or something between, joining us to do that from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Matthew Slaughter, Associate Dean and Professor of International Economics at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Matthew Slaughter, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me here.
And with us from Washington is Robert Scott, Senior International Economist and Director of International Programs at the Economic Policy Institute. Its board includes a lot of top U.S. labor leaders. Robert Scott, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Let's go first to volume. Last year, a record year for foreign purchases of U.S. assets, $138 billion-plus companies, the entities bought outright, $400-and-some billion invested in American companies with foreign cash last year. Bottom line, Robert Scott, is this exactly what we need right now when the U.S. looks kind of strapped?
Well, Tom, I think it's an unfortunate byproduct of our trade position with the rest of the world. We're running and have been for many years huge trade deficits. That means we're spending more than we're earning. We have to finance that somehow, and the way we've been doing it is selling off our assets. Companies and countries are realizing that instead of buying U.S. Treasury bills, it would pay them much more to buy up U.S. assets. The downside of this is what you've talked about. When they buy these companies, they often tend to hollow them out, and we see a decline in U.S. employment and a rise in imports by those companies, and that is not good for the U.S. economy.
Give us a sense of what's going. We've talked about Anheuser-Busch. You've got old things going, the Chrysler Building in New York to be owned by Abu Dhabi now. You've got cutting-edge stuff going. In the newspapers today, Genentech, big biotech firm, 100% ownership will now go to Roche Holding in Switzerland. What's the range of things going, Bob Scott?
Well, it goes, I think, across the spectrum, but it focuses intensively, I think, on both the manufacturing sector, where we actually produce goods and import and export them, and also in financials. And I think the manufacturing sector, for example, from the low tech end, we had the Indian company GHLC, which last year bought out the Dan River Textile Company. We've got Miller Beer, which is owned by a South African company. Coors going to Molson's. We've got IBM's PC unit, Lenovo, which went to which went to Lenovo company in China. So it really spans the spectrum. Gateway went to Acer. So we've really seen U.S. companies across the technology spectrum being acquired by foreign companies.
Matthew Slaughter, you know this can raise American hackles. It can in any country, and yet economically there are benefits here too. I'm looking in the Wall Street Journal and they're quoting a guy in a St. Louis bar who was going to get the King of Beers logo tattooed on his rib cage. He says he won't do it now. He won't drink Budweiser anymore. He's going back to Wild Turkey. And the Wall Street Journal points out that Wild Turkey, the Kentucky bourbon, is now owned by the French drinks giant Pernod Ricard. Maybe this is just the way of the world, Matthew Slaughter.
Well, that speaks to a really interesting point, which is part of what's going on is there's a lot of new source countries and new source companies that are undertaking this foreign direct investment into the United States. And that reflects the very strong economic growth that's been happening in many countries around the world. And Robert cited some countries like China and India and countries in former Central Eastern Europe. They now are developing their own world-class companies. And as they expand beyond their home borders, the U.S. being the single biggest market in the world remains a very attractive destination for a lot of companies. And InBev is another one of them.
You have written that, bottom line, this is good for the United States and for Americans. Why? How?
Two big reasons. Robert touched on a really important one. One is our ongoing trade deficit that we run with the rest of the world. We need to finance that excess of buying more imports from them than they sell to us, and we do that by selling assets. But one asset class is our companies, and the foreign direct investment that comes in when foreign firms buy parts or all of our companies, they tend to be very stable, very long-term investments compared to some other portfolio options, and that brings greater stability to the overall U.S. economy. So that's one reason. And the second big issue is when you look at the level of these companies individually, they tend to be very good, high-productivity, high-performance companies. They do lots of research and development in the United States. They do a lot of capital investment. And the bottom line of that shows up really in workers' paychecks. These companies, these insourcing firms in the United States, tend to pay much higher compensation than do the rest of the companies in the private sector.
Robert Scott, what do you make of that? And before you go to it, I mean, something that surprised me, I really had no idea. We're told that our trade deficit numbers are improving, but I didn't know that when they're improved, that includes the sale of U.S. assets and companies overseas. So it makes you wonder if we're selling the engine out of the car, you know, and claiming that as progress.
Well, I have real concerns about that, too. And I think part of the problem here is that many of our companies are becoming really stateless enterprises. This is a growing concern in the economics profession, something that Harvard economist Larry Summers mentioned to the Financial Times a few months ago. And I think this really I think raises questions for us as to how we should, as a nation, think about interacting with these companies. In terms of responding to Matthew's points, I think you need to have a benchmark. For example, he talks about those high-paid jobs in these companies or investing in the U.S. Well, the question is, what kind of jobs are they displacing? Much of the investment takes place in manufacturing. Manufacturing jobs tend to pay much better than jobs in other industries, especially for workers without a college degree, who tend to be employed heavily in making things in the manufacturing sector. And those workers earn about, as I say, about 20% more in manufacturing overall. So it's a real question what the benchmark is. And what we do know is, at the bottom line, that these foreign companies have actually eliminated about 4 million jobs between 1990 and 2005, either through layoffs or by spinning off subsidiaries of companies that they buy up. So they're actually reducing payrolls in the U.S., and they have a trade deficit. If we look at them as importing entities, they have a trade deficit that's tripled in that period, going from $170 to $450 billion. And that has directly contributed to eliminating good jobs in the United States.
I'm not sure what you mean in each of those. First of all, when you say that they've eliminated 4 million jobs, American companies, I guess, eliminate jobs too. Are you saying that net-net they represent a net loss of jobs to the United States? And when you say they contribute to the trade deficit, I'm not sure what you mean by that, Robert Scott.
Sure. Let's take them one at a time. On the jobs question, these companies employed about 4 million workers in 1990. Most of the jobs added by foreign investors are of the InBev type. They buy up an existing U.S. asset that has hundreds of thousands of U.S. employees. And if you add up all of those purchases over the between 1990 and 2005, they acquired almost 5 million additional employees. They had startups that were actually a very small number, about 300 and some thousand workers in startups like the new Honda plants in Ohio. Mm-hmm. Add those all up, you come up to a number that totals around 9 million jobs. But if you look at the actual number of people employed in 2005, it was only about 525,000. So somehow they lost those 4 million jobs, and the way they lost them was, as I said, they're laying off people. We're talking about layoffs in St. Louis. I think this has been a broad trend, or through selling off subsidiaries.
And how do they contribute to a trade deficit, you say? The same way American companies do? They're exporting more than they import?
Exactly. But what these companies do
importing more than they export, excuse me. Yeah.
Precisely. So what these companies often do is they hollow out U.S. companies. For example, I mentioned earlier the company Dan River. Mm-hmm. The trade press talked explicitly about Indian companies buying up U.S. textile firms that had existing marketing networks. So they were buying the brand. They would buy the company, shut the factories down, import the textiles from India. And so in that way, our imports would go up and our trade deficit would go up and U.S. Employment would go down. And I find myself wondering, what is InBev going to do with the distribution network that Budweiser has in the United States? What kind of beer is it going to push in that network? More Budweiser, or are they going to bring in more imported brands?
You would think it would be cheaper to sell Budweiser made in the USA than something shipped in from abroad, or maybe the brand doesn't have to be shipped from abroad. Matthew, I want to come to you on that, but let me turn to our callers first, if I may, from Dubuque, Iowa. Bryce is on the line. Hi, Bryce. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty good. What do you see, Bryce?
Well, what I see here is it's kind of I find that America right now has been very, hypocritical as far as, we're worried about illegal immigration and anymore. It's like we're shipping all the jobs out anyway. I mean, we're concerned about illegal, immigrants taking our jobs when, in fact, we're shipping more jobs out than they would ever take.
So you can give the jobs away this way or that way is how it looks to you.
Yeah, it's like either way we look at it, we're going to lose these jobs.
But are they really lost? I mean, Budweiser is still going to have a lot of American employees. Some of these companies need the capital that foreign firms represent. Maybe they're going to bring dynamism in, Bryce.
I think these people at Budweiser got their head in the sand if they think this company's not going to come in and clean house. I mean, they're going to come in and they're going to want their own people in there. They have ways of running things. I mean, they've got $52 billion for a reason. They run a tight ship. And they're going to go in there and they're going to eliminate any dead wood they think is laying around, and this is just the beginning.
But maybe it's good to eliminate dead, bring in some new capital, some new drive, and eliminate some dead wood. I mean, isn't that what Americans have told the rest of the world to do for a long time?
I agree with that if the dead wood is being replaced with new American workers. I mean, they're going to eliminate and eliminate and eliminate. And that's not just Budweiser. I think you're going to see, I'm not going to claim to be Nostradamus here, but I think you're going to start seeing, GM doing the same thing. I think as these companies start to hurt, they're going to start looking for these easy money, abroad. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, Bryce, we got it, and thank you very much for your call. Matthew Slaughter, you hear Robert Scott's view of what's going on, and Bryce in Dubuque saying tip of the iceberg looks gloom and doom, but you've got quite a different view of this. I guess you better make that case further.
Sure. Both Bryce and I think Robert pick up on a very important common thing, which is the dynamism of the U.S. economy. If you look at the U.S. economy overall, and this speaks to Robert's point about the benchmark, every hour that America is open for business, there's about 25,000 jobs that are destroyed. Every hour, over 4 million jobs in gross terms every month in the U.S. economy are separated in terms of worker firm separations. Now, there's about that many jobs that get created every month as well, but this extreme dynamism that we see in the U.S. labor market is part of the underlying strength of the U.S. economy. That's not to say that every one of these single separation isn't difficult for individuals and their communities and the firms that are involved. But that dynamism has been in the U.S. economy for generations, and it's the right benchmark, I think, against which we want to look at these insourcing companies. Robert's right that there's a lot of gross job creation and destruction inside these firms. But if you look on net, what's really important is over the past generation, the net employment in the United States, the number of Americans that work at these insourcing companies, has been on the rise. It's now about 5.3 million workers. A generation ago, it was only about 3 million. So despite these gross flows that we see of firms starting up, expanding, and firms retrenching and shrinking sometimes, on net, the presence of these insourcing companies has been rising. And again, they're good companies in lots of ways. The unionization rates in these insourcing companies is higher than it is in the rest of the private sector. Oftentimes, the benchmark is not, boy, an expanding, growing, strong U.S. company. Sometimes it's a U.S. company that, like Budweiser, has a fantastic history and legacy, but in recent times, maybe struggling a bit, and oftentimes new foreign owners bring in new dynamism, new capital, new ideas that allow these firms to regain their footing.
Bryce, thanks very much for your call. Let's get a call from Adam in Boston. Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I want to qualify what I'm saying. I'm in the venture capital business, and we're the people who are supposed to be creating the sort of
the future.
Driver. This is what we're told, the future. That's right. And I guess I'm frustrated with the conversation so far. I'm not sure that it's the right thing to have economists on things like this, versus maybe people who are a little bit more in the trenches. Look, it's always good to make your own stuff and be in control of your means of production. And right now, what's happening is that we're being forced to sell those things. Like you made a comment about selling the engine out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
Because of a generation of profligate trade policy, of policy which favored consumption over production. And losing control of your capital assets, the things that you actually make stuff with, is never a good thing, particularly if, as we've been told as justification for so much outsourcing of our manufacturing, that we're outsourcing low-skilled jobs in favor of high-skilled jobs, i.e. white-collar jobs. And yet we hear, as is perfectly logical, InBev did not buy Anheuser-Busch so they could continue to support their middle management. They're going to lay them off, and we hear the word hollowing out. And there's just so much sophistry, I think, and I don't want to knock the economists too hard. They don't really do much other than think about this stuff. And I think they get very confused with trying to apply econometric models to something which fundamentally doesn't model very well mathematically. So we have to have sympathy for them. But it's a little bit aggravating to hear all these justifications. You know, maybe we have 2 million more jobs than a generation ago. We went from 3 to 5.5 million. But we've also, our population has grown by what, 30 or 40
yep,
million?
Yeah, plenty. Mm-hmm.
So we hear all these interesting, sort of noisy statistics, which make for very good fodder for conversation back and forth. But at the end of the day, we don't make much stuff anymore. And making stuff, and controlling the means of making stuff, and making the decisions about what you make and where you sell it, are what typify a robust, healthy economy. And the more we gut this stuff out, and the more that we borrow money from abroad and have to sell assets, it's not good long-term for the strength of our culture and our society and our ability to control those things.
Doesn't feel good, Adam. You make a strong case. We'll come back and hear from Matthew Slaughter and Robert Scott. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this about U.S. companies, U.S. assets for sale, and going fast to foreign buyers with that weak dollar and strong foreign companies going global. Record sales of U.S. assets to overseas owners in 2007, and we're on a pretty hot clip again this year. We've been joined by Matthew Slaughter, Associate Dean and Professor of International Economics at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He says this is good for the USA. And Robert Scott, joining us from Washington, from the Economic Policy Institute, who says, watch out, not so good. Robert Scott, you heard our venture capitalist Adam call in just before the break, saying it doesn't look good to him. It looks like you're selling off the capital assets you need to create the future. What about it?
Well, I think Adam is absolutely right on point. I think we do need to have more emphasis on producing goods here in the United States, and I think that's a national problem. On the other hand, we have to, I think I want to correct one thing he said, we actually do still make a lot of things here in the United States. We have a large manufacturing sector. It's quite vibrant. Employs close to 14 million workers, had shipments of almost $4 trillion in 2007. So it's a big part of our economy, and it needs to be bigger. You know, we need to ship more goods to the rest of the world to shrink this trade gap that we've been talking about, and that will put more people to work and create good jobs. But we can't rely on foreign companies to do that for us. We have to have national policies that are going to make that happen, policies to increase our competitiveness, to invest in new technologies to produce the products we can sell to the rest of the world.
Matthew Slaughter, how about it? You say Bob says we can't rely on foreign companies. You heard our venture capital caller Adam saying, what are you talking about? We're selling our capital assets, like selling our seed corn here to, you know, for some cash right now.
I think we'd all agree that what ultimately makes U.S. workers more productive is the ideas and the know-how and the physical capital that allows them to make good goods and services. And the reality is a lot of investment in physical capital, in research and development, and an increasing share, not just in dollar values, but a rising share of the U.S. total, is accounted for by these insourcing companies in the United States. You know, you played that very interesting ad from 1976, the Here Comes the King ad, and I was smiling as I listened to that. It's important, I think, to keep in mind that in 1976, countries like China and India and much of Central and Eastern Europe, economically, they were on the moon. And right now, every day that kind of goes along, they're becoming more and more integrated in the global economy. And part of their economic growth means ideas and good companies and good processes are being created outside the U.S. as well. And that's a resource that for good jobs and good wages in the United States, I want our country to be able to tap into.
Tap into maybe through ownership that spans from Shanghai to Chicago. Let's go to Virginia. Ed's calling from Route 81 in Virginia. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I wanted to say, I think that this is the bottom line mentality. Our job to be an exporter to break labor, and that the same investors are going to drive up the Dow, but the jobs are going to be in India and Micronesia and overseas, and the profits will be going to people that really don't need them, and the people that really need the jobs are going to be losing them.
Ed, we've got the perspective right there, and we'll pick it up from Virginia. Let me get one more call right here from Vermont, Burlington, Vermont, and Tom. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to make the point. I'm from Europe, and I'm from Great Britain.
All right.
And back in the 70s, a lot of companies in Britain got bought up. Companies got closed down. Arabs were buying whole castles and islands in Scotland. Everybody was panicking. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think overall it actually made things better, because I think what happens if the economy gets too stagnant and stuck in its ways, it just gets stagnant. And people are incredibly inventive, and this country has a massive potential. We're just at the beginning, and people talking about it being going down the drain, this is ridiculous. Some things need to change. I think cities need to become much more self-sufficient and energy and food production themselves, and just being more environmental. But
Tom, we've got the perspective. You saw it happen in the UK, in the 70s. It looks to you like it worked out all right. Robert Scott, what about it? Is it possible that the economy is so globalized now that it really doesn't matter where the ownership is? You hear our caller Ed's concern out of Virginia that what you end up with is something that works well for people who can invest anywhere on the planet, but for people who need a job somewhere near where they live in the U.S., not so great.
Well, I think Ed's exactly right. What we've seen over the last 3 decades is that working people, those without a college degree, and that makes up about 80% of the labor force, 70 to 80% of the labor force, those workers have not seen a raise. Their wages have been essentially stagnant in real terms throughout that period. And most of the benefits of growing income have gone to families in the top 10% of the income distribution, and to people in particular with very advanced degrees, not just college degrees, but advanced degrees have gotten almost all of the benefits. So I think he's exactly right, and we need a strategy that's going to help deliver good jobs as good wages to people across the income spectrum. And I think one way to do that is to try and create some of those technologies your second caller was talking about. But I don't think we can depend on foreign companies to do that for us. I think we have to make those investments ourselves. We have to develop national policies, for example, to develop clean energy and renewables that can reduce our reliance on oil and give us products to export.
Matthew, we'll come to you on that, but let me get a call first here from Middlesex, Vermont, and Virginia. Virginia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Yeah, I live right by Ben & Jerry's.
The ice cream company, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great company. A few years ago, they sold out to Unilever, a foreign company. And
Anglo-Dutch company, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and they have stayed in state. We negotiated a really good contract that they stayed in state. They stay true to Ben & Jerry's founding beliefs of donating to good causes, and they kept jobs here. In fact, they keep expanding, and we've done really well, and I think it can work for Anheuser-Busch, too, if they try hard and give it a chance.
Virginia, thanks for the report. Ben & Jerry's off in 2000 to Unilever, Anglo-Dutch company, and it looks okay to Virginia. But Matthew Slaughter, I wonder how far does this go? Are we so globalized that it really doesn't matter where one-time American assets are owned these days? Can that be?
Oh, no, I think it does matter a lot. And Robert mentions a very important point, which is thinking about the distribution of the economic growth and aggregate gains that come from technology innovation, that come from international trade and investment, and this issue of insourcing that we've been discussing is one of them.
Insourcing means what? Bringing foreign capital
companies,
jobs with it to this country?
Exactly. And again, the anecdotes and examples are important, but I think to guide the public policy, the aggregate statistics are really, really important.
But you guys interpret them differently. Robert says it's a net loss. You say it's a net gain. Poor citizen trying to figure it out.
No, that's true. Robert and I can continue that conversation elsewhere. But in terms of paychecks, which is really important, in 2005, the most recent year data that we have, the typical American working at one of these insourcing companies earned a little over $66,000, and that was over 30% higher than the private sector average compensation that year.
Is that because they shed all their lower-paid employees and moved those jobs abroad? Is that where we come to a cost in jobs?
A lot of the reason is because these are companies that are undertaking R&D. They're investing in their people. They reinvest a lot of profits back in the United States, $65 billion in reinvested earnings in the U.S. And all these things tend to make workers more productive, and it shows up in the bottom line of their paychecks.
Headed toward $500 billion of foreign direct investment last year, a record year for foreign purchases. How far do you think this could go, Matthew?
Well, it remains to be seen. I think a lot of it will depend, as callers and Robert rightly pointed out, on the aggregate U.S. Trade imbalance. That's going to be one guiding force. But again, I think the growth that's happening in the rest of the world and good companies around the world, they view the United States as a real important part of their overall global business strategy. And so the magnitudes may have been flow again. On net, I think we'll continue to see more foreign businesses having operations here. And like Ben & Jerry's, like the Virginia pointed out with the example from Vermont, you see a lot of success stories with these investments in the United States.
Robert Scott, we've just got a few seconds here, but does this balance out in the end? What do you think? Do we all end up working for somebody in Paris or Shanghai or Belgium, or does it naturally self-correct?
No, I'm afraid it won't. I think there'll be no natural self-correction, and we'll end up with more people working in Belgium and Shanghai and fewer people working here unless we do something to create jobs here at home.
Watch out. Heads up. It's happening right now. Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, thank you very much for being with us this hour. And Matthew Slaughter at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Matthew Slaughter, Professor Slaughter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, a look at the rise of short sellers in the markets and their impact on the economy. This is On Point. There is plenty of finger-pointing these days around the slide in stock prices. One of the big targets, short sellers, who made at least $1.4 billion in just July, we're told, betting against the stocks of mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Short sellers make money when market prices fall. Right now, they're reportedly betting more than $1 trillion on the collapse of global stock prices. And the SEC is stepping in. Jesse Eisinger is a senior writer for Portfolio Magazine. He's been following the short sellers' rise. Jesse, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
$1 trillion out there bet against future prices in global markets, betting on a stock market collapse? That sounds overwhelming.
It's not going to be overwhelming. It's only about less than 5% of the NYSE's total share volume is shorted. So we have to keep this in perspective. It's a rising number of investors that are shorting stocks now because people with money, like pension funds, are giving more money to the kinds of investors that do engage in short sellers, which are hedge funds. But it's a very small percentage of the overall assets that are invested in the world economy. So the idea that short sellers are somewhat, dominant force in the market is really kind of an overrated, sort of exaggerated notion.
Everybody loves to hate short sellers because they make money when the markets go down, and most investors are in it for the markets to go up. So
exactly. Yes, they're profiting from other people's misery. It's a natural thing for people to dislike.
But the defenders of short sellers, and you may be among them, Jesse, say they've got an important role in our economy, in the markets. What?
I have defended them on numerous occasions. We have a free market economy, and if we do have a free market economy, what we need to do is have free market forces that exercise a critical eye. We believe in regulation, but we also want investors to look at companies critically, and this is what short sellers do. They're kind of like investigative reporters or private detectives, and what they do is they go out and find companies that are scamming their customers or that are overvalued, honest but overvalued, and they bet against them. And the most famous case is Jim Chanos, who runs a hedge fund in New York, who bet against Enron.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the first people to really question Enron's accounting. He couldn't figure out how they made money. And he spoke to reporters, notably Bethany McLean at Fortune magazine. She wrote a very famous story, and that kind of burst the Enron bubble. And that's a service to society. We want people to expose fraudulent companies for what they are.
You've said that if government regulators were doing their job, the SEC and others, there would be fewer opportunities for short sellers. We wouldn't get into maybe some of these bubbles around companies with significant weaknesses that short sellers eventually come in, point to, and profit from.
There's no question in my mind that better regulation would cut out a good business for short sellers. If regulators had no one, short sellers, for instance, did not cause banks to go out and wildly lend to home buyers in 2004, 2005, and 2006. Nobody was forcing their hand to do that. They did that on their own. And when we talk about these loans that were done with low documentation or no documentation or people who do liar loans, that was not short sellers causing these kind of excesses. It was banks themselves and banks that are not regulated as banks, non-banks, but financial companies. And if we had better regulation, they would potentially not have gotten into this mess, in which case there would have been no opportunity for short sellers to bet against them when they were doing so in 2007.
But now we've got this global credit crunch, risk of a financial meltdown around the world, and you've got huge investors, hedge funds and others, have been betting against the future of important, financial companies. And here's where the SEC has come in with a 1 month ban on what's called naked shorting of the shares of 17 investment banks. So they're riding to the rescue saying you can't do what for 1 month, Jesse?
Well, it's complicated and bureaucratic, but what you do when you short sell is you arrange to borrow the shares before you sell them. And in fact, it's always been illegal for most investors to sell without borrowing the shares first. And what the SEC is doing is trying to crack down on this and raise the bureaucracy, to tighten up the bureaucracy, so that if you're a broker dealer, you really arrange to borrow the shares before the hedge funds that are shorting it actually go out and short it.
So you have to get more skin in the game before you make this kind of short play.
Well, Yes, to some extent, but it's really a kind of window dressing. It's kind of a PR stunt. This is already illegal for most cases, and what the SEC is doing is trying to act like it's doing something, and it's easy to blame, as you said, short sellers because they seem sort of anti-American, they seem negative.
But they could also cause a lot of pain and a lot of 401k balances if they bring these down. Does it seem to be working? Has it taken the heat off, the pressure off some of these giant investment banks?
It's hard to say whether it really was working, but last week we saw a huge rally in the stocks of financial companies, and to some extent that may have had something to do with this new SEC pronouncement. It may have just been due to the fact that investors were kind of willing to buy stocks and thinking that there was a bottom in financial stocks. So the correlation causation here are hard to prove. But the short sellers can't cause – I'm a believer in the idea that short sellers cannot cause fine institutions to go under. I don't think that short sellers can gang up on financial companies, even financial companies, which depend on confidence in the market. But if you're a company that produces a product and the product is selling, a short seller can't come in and create a terrifying scenario and scare all the investors away, because there's much more money, smart money, in hedge funds and private equity firms and mutual funds and pension funds.
And they've got up their sleeve, but $1 trillion now, a bet the other way. Jesse Eisinger at Portfolio Magazine, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.